Writer Elizabeth Spencer is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Elizabeth Spencer is a writer of novels and short stories. She is also the author of a play, Release or Sale. Her novels include The Voice at the Back Door, The Light on the Piazza, and The Night Travelers. Elizabeth Spencer's Landscapes of the Heart, a memoir, was published this year, and this afternoon we talk with her about her life and work. Spencer grew up in Carrollton, a small Mississippi town 100 miles south of Memphis, 100 miles north of Jackson. She left the South as a young woman and spent many years living in Europe and Canada. Today she lives with her husband in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. As we talk, your questions and comments are welcome. You can join the conversation with a telephone call. In Champaign-Urbana, our number 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Elizabeth Spencer's memoir, Landscapes of the Heart, is published by Random House. Again, our numbers, toll-free 1-800-222-9455, and in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Elizabeth Spencer, good afternoon and welcome.
Oh, hello.
How are you?
I'm fine.
In Landscapes of the Heart, you tell us about your earliest memory of walking to your father. What is the earliest memory you have of having memory?
I guess you don't call it that for a long time.
Mm-hmm. But exactly.
When you learn the word, you've already had the concept.
Yeah.
Haven't you?
Yeah.
And so it would be a sort of a psychological study to find out when that concept establishes itself in the child's mind. But I don't think anybody ever asked me before. I just took it for granted that some things I recalled and began recalling as soon as I was early enough to recall.
It just struck me as memory is so important, of course, in a memoir.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, you know, how interesting it would be to think back and try and put your finger on the point.
Well,
when
I tried to scratch back beyond before that particular incident of the suitcase and having to learn to walk, but I quite honestly feel that that was the second time I learned to walk. I'd been very ill, and I think maybe I had to learn a lot of things all over again when I was about two. So this goes back to maybe the second time. Maybe if my mother was still alive, I could ask her, and she could pinpoint it exactly. But unfortunately, all the people who were present are gone.
Yeah. Memory is a tricky thing, though, even if one had one's mother around to ask, you know.
We have false memories sometimes,
yeah.
And are convinced that things that were actual. There was a thing about a trial once. Somebody said, well, he's as unreliable as an eyewitness. Which to me kind of pinpoints it. But I tried to be very, very honest, and these are things that have stuck with me.
Uh-huh.
My friend Eudora Welty said a very illuminating thing once, because she wrote a memoir some years ago you may know about, One Writer's Beginnings. She said, when you had one memory, if you lift that up, you find another memory under it, and so on. Other things fill in around the crucial memory. Now, when I remember that thing about the suitcase and getting up and walking, I also can see the room it was in.
Mm-hmm.
That comes with the memory. And I can see people around me and my father reaching out to me. And the whole setting comes real, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
And then many other things behaved like that. Once I started writing this book, I could remember a great many things that I thought were lost forever.
I am not a writer, but I would think that memory and the idea or the ideas of home would be so critical to the work being, you know, being a writer, that's what you draw from?
Well, I do a lot. Of course I did in this book, because most of my childhood was spent there at the family foundation, and excursions out from the home as visits and so on are related there to old ladies and others in the family connection or family friendship. Always there are done with the foregone conclusion that you're going to return home. So in a way, it's a base of operation and, you know, something that you always have.
Mm. Are memory and home the same?
Oh, no.
And why not? Why do you say they are not?
Well, it seems not a question that anybody would ask. Memory would fill you in from anything experienced in any place, whether it was home or not.
Hmm. Of course. you write in Landscapes of the Heart about returning home, and you write it's not that you can't go home, but there isn't any home to go to.
Oh, well, that was after the various contretemps upheavals in the family that I had with my father, who never wanted me to be a writer and who tried to make everything impossible for me to continue. Furthermore, he was more and more narrow and rigid in his thinking about everything, and so gradually, I was sort of, if I wanted to stay there, nobody would speak to me kind of thing. And so I was sort of squeezed out.
Mm.
It was a painful law. One reason I didn't want to write this memoir is I don't believe in going back into painful things so much. But I knew if I had to, I was going to have to explain my life as having taken place in so many different locales, and that was crucial to that decision and to those events that followed.
We should probably fill in the audience here about that time in your life after being abroad for a couple of years. You had been to college, and then after being abroad, you returned home, and you and your parents had a real falling out, particularly you and your father.
I went. I had published two books. I got a Guggenheim Fellowship. I went to Italy to work on another novel. The novel I was working on actually took place in Mississippi, but I had loved Italy from a previous visit and decided to go there, and I was away for 2 years. Now, in homecoming that time, I had thought of myself as really all set to take up my life again in Mississippi. I had been teaching at the University of Mississippi, and I thought I had many happy connections in the state. However, I ran into a wall of disapproval at home for one thing. There was a very famous murder case that took place in the Delta, not far from where my father had some property, and it was the murder of a Chicago boy who had come down and was supposed to have made some sexual remark or something to an attractive white woman. And he was dragged out at night and told to recant and apologize. He wouldn't do it. And they killed him. And so I thought this was so shocking. It was a horrible beating. His body was, in an awful mess when they found it. And I let go with the opinion that I thought was so terrible. And my mother thought it was terrible, too. But my father didn't want me to express any opinion about it at all. And the more such topics came up, I began to realize that he had changed from being a fairly liberal-minded, easygoing person toward race relationships into a very rigidly reactionary person. That happened throughout Mississippi. That period in Mississippi, beginning about then, that was about 1955, I sometimes refer to as the Troubles in the Irish sense, where nothing but conflict was going to go on for maybe the next 10 or 12 years. And my getting out was only one of the many people who left Mississippi who couldn't stand it. Things are a lot better now. And it was a necessary thing to go through, but it was certainly very painful. And in many cases, disastrous for people who came there or who were living there.
Knowing that history, when I was looking over your first novel, Fire in the Morning.
Oh, yes. Where'd you find that?
In the library.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Still around, is it?
Yes.
Oh, I thought it was very immature, but some people still like it.
Well, I was struck by something a character says at the end of the novel. I ought to have left years ago, but somehow you get in the habit of being where you are.
Oh, yeah, that was that character, Lance, going away at the end. That's right. I remember that.
Yeah. It seems now 1948 is 7 years ahead of 1955, when it was time for you to really break away for a while.
Yes, I didn't have such an ingrained displeasure with Mississippi before I went to Italy for 2 years, but things had begun to develop in a bad direction very rapidly, and this was the time when the infamous citizens' councils were being formed, you know, and the object was to keep black people from voting at all. And so all this had developed at a gallop while I was abroad. And the book I'd written was based in racial relationships at a time just previous to that, The Voice at the Back Door, and that was never mentioned while I was at home.
How were you treated by folks at home and other Southerners in the wake of your treatment of race and politics in, you know, in your books, particularly The Voice at the Back Door?
Oh, well, sometimes I think there are two Mississippis at the very least. There may be many Mississippis. all my writer friends, the book was well reviewed in Mississippi. My literate friends and my writer friends, and it was well reviewed in New York. It was well reviewed in Mississippi. There was not a great solidarity in people's thinking in Mississippi. It was just that the wrong people seemed to get hold of everything in the political arena. And I guess popular opinion was pretty solidified in a certain very, very shocking way. But other people have explained it in different ways by saying, well, you've got to realize the old way of life in Mississippi was dying, and there bound to have been death throes because there was an established order, an old order, and it was giving way to the new. And so you're bound to have some confrontations. But I wasn't a condemned person. I could still go back quite often to Mississippi and see all my friends and all that.
And you did?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But also, I think you used the words jump the fence. You had to make a break.
Well, that's just probably me. I'm not a person that can be. I had to learn this gradually about myself. I can't be rigidly confined in any area where certain things are expected of me, and I'll just turn around and leave. Or I'll rebel in different ways. I don't believe any person has. People don't have a right to constrict the freedom of thinking and speaking of anybody. And say that there's a long list of things you can never talk about. There's a long list of things you can never do, ways you have to dress. You know, it wasn't a life for me. Probably not for you either.
No.
Would you say so?
Yeah, I think if somebody says you can't or you shouldn't.
There you go.
It's like, why not?
Mm-hmm.
And what would happen if I did?
Yeah.
I think that sometimes one has to really put aside advice given in one's best interest, but make one's own way.
Mm.
So for you, there was never then any problem getting out of the habit of being where you were.
Getting out of the habit of being where I were.
Yeah, where you were. I mean,
well, I went off to boarding school when I was about 16. So that gave me somewhat similar but a new locale, and then I went to graduate school, and then I worked in different places, so no, it didn't create, you mean homesickness? Well,
yeah, was it, I mean, for you to leave, was it momentous for you to go off to school?
I suppose, except it was only 100 miles away, and my cousin was the president of the school, and I had other cousins in Jackson, so it wasn't much of a dislocation at all. Now, the major dislocation, if you want to call it that, was when I went to Vanderbilt. It was during the war, and things were kind of abnormal in the sense of so many of the men were off in the service. But on the other hand, I got into a perfectly exhilarating experience of being in a highly intellectual university where many things were discussed, that, not that people were prohibited from discussing them in Mississippi. It's just that so few people even knew about them. And so I began to be very stimulated by this experience. So it wasn't a painful experience. It was very stimulating, exhilarating.
Mm-hmm. Do you suppose that you were very close to your grandfather on your mm-hmm. mother's side and your uncle?
Mm-hmm.
These two men, in your love of them and their love of you and their nurturing of you, I wonder if those two men help you become the woman that you did become, and the sort of a woman who could think for herself, who enjoyed the experience of thinking.
Well, yes. My grandfather died when I was too young to really get into the thought side of a relationship where you express ideas and all that. We were just mainly on a very loving basis. And to this day, I can't remember what we talked about. I was just his constant companion.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to stand around and listen to him talking to other men. And I don't really know the content of anything they said, but just that he was well known and well received everywhere. It was sort of nice. And then when he died, he used to read a lot. And he'd gotten quite elderly, and my uncle, who was terribly fond of him, used to say, "You only need to give Father 3 books. One he's just finished, one he's reading now, and one he's going to read when he gets through with that one, and then you start all over." So, because his memory wasn't as good as it was previously, but he did read a great deal, I remember that. And he must have had some ideas about those books and everything. But
In order to put this into perspective a bit, perhaps we should say that your grandfather was 14 years of age at the outset of the Civil War.
I'm not quite sure. I'd have to look up dates on that. I know the war had been going on maybe for a year or two, and he went to volunteer when he was 14 and lied about his age, but they called him. They said, "You know, boy, you really are too young." So he went back home and had to run a 2,000-acre plantation. He was the only man on the place, he said, by himself. So that must have been quite a period.
Mm. And your uncle, he and his wife had, his first wife didn't have children, and so you and your brother were.
Yeah, we were certainly.
You were.
Very, very welcome there and felt that we were being, I don't know, we had a second home there.
Yeah. Mm. And you would ride with your uncle. You would bring your horse down. And
well, in those days, those were pre-Jeep days, you understand. And a lot of the plantation was, the roads were dirt, and they would get muddy, and some of the land was just recently cleared even. It was swampy. The delta's inclined to be very swampy. So riding a horse through to see what work was being done and supervising everything was the only thing to do. And so I rejoiced in having my horse there and could go with him and see everything that was being done and talk a blue streak. Now, he was the one that talked to me. We were great talkers. And he encouraged me about reading certain things that he liked and, you know, telling me about people and how he judged and measured. Judge people and, you know, have people measured up with his ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And he was always, he was a good-humored man. He was always laughing and singing some little foolish song or something, and we had a great time.
I'm imagining that that would be quite unusual for a little girl to be riding around in the, you know, in the country at that time.
Oh, you mean the ride I took alone? Nobody can get over that. I thought it was the most usual thing in the world. And I said, you mean your parents let you ride 13 miles in the country? Well, the point was everybody knew us. You know, that was ages ago, and life was pretty stable back then. People stayed where they were born, and it didn't seem like anything to me. I wasn't. There was one part of the road that made me a little bit nervous, but otherwise, there was not much anxiety in letting me do such a thing.
How long does it take to ride 13 miles on a horse?
Oh, depends on how fast you take the horse along. But I left. I remember I left early and got there about dinner time, so it must have been about 3 or 4 hours.
But
it was a sort of adventure, I guess. I was glad when it was over because it's a long road and nobody to talk to, and it was necessary for getting my horse down there.
I just can't picture other little girls of the time doing that, nor can I picture little girls of the time riding with their uncle around his place.
Well, you think that was unique. I thought it was the most average thing in the world, but, you know, I later came to realize that my life was very much on the outside of most people's experience rather than being common.
When did you begin how old were you when you began to write?
I think I recount something of that in my memoir that I got. Very much of an urge to write, observing firelight at night in the room. I tried to draw it, and when I found out I couldn't draw, I wrote a poem about it. This occurred, I think, just about the time I learned to write. Before that, I used to make up stories and tell them to myself and some playmate or other. And my mother used to always be reading stories to me, and I heard stories all the time about relatives and different people. And so it just kind of evolved naturally that way. But where one gets the urge from in the first place, that's mysterious. I don't know. If you know writers, and you must interview writers all the time, you might ask them and make a list of the different things they say, because I don't really know where it comes from.
What kind of stories did you enjoy your mother telling you before you learned to read?
Well, it wasn't so much that she was telling stories. Other people told stories a lot, but she was a good reader aloud, and I was sick a good bit when I was a little child. And she would read. She read and read and read to me. She read Uncle Remus. She read Arthurian legend. She read Greek myths. She read Story of the Bible. She read Grimm's fairy tales. I suppose before that there was Peter Rabbit. So it went on like that, and finally we got to things like Peter Pan and different ones, Alice in Wonderland. On we went. So there wasn't much stopping it once it got started, because I loved the things. She had good taste in what she found for me to read, too. That's important, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
So when I got to graduate school and found there were so many references to these things, Greek myths, story, the Bible, Arthurian legend, and people didn't know anything about them, I was amazed, because it seemed to me I knew everything that went on in those stories.
When did you begin to feel as a writer, I'm coming into it, or maybe, I don't know what the experience is like for a writer. What is it like to sort of, to feel maybe you're coming into some power, you're coming into a point where, yeah, this is good, this is where I want to go?
Well, I always felt from the time my teachers in grammar school began to praise little themes I had done and little stories I did just for the occasional assignment, they began to praise those, and I began to feel encouraged. I guess praise is a great stimulant. But the fact that some of these people that praised me were also people that I respected highly and thought of as being kind of, I suppose, role models or something like that, was even better. It depends on the person who's praising you as to whether it really carries weight, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I went to this small girl school in Jackson, Mississippi, and one or two of the people there took a strong interest in my work. Everywhere I went, if I showed my work to anybody, they would immediately pick up on praising it and thinking, you know, that if I was promising for a long time. Writers get hung with that word,
yeah.
Can't stand it anymore, but to be promising is somewhere where you feel like, I might as well stop right now. All I'm going to be is promising. But finally, when I wrote a novel and it was accepted, I guess that's when I felt I could stand on my own two feet, because here was actually a check. Here was money in hand.
Yeah. Mm. But a promising young writer, that's the stuff of rejection letters.
Right. Well, I suppose by then I was a promising first novelist. That's another category you can get. That's another ditch you can get caught in.
Now, you would send short stories.
I'm sorry?
You sent short stories off.
I started writing short stories. I still like short stories because I thought being shorter they'd be easier to finish and publish. But I think at the beginning, well, I would send them out and the editors would write back and say, we like this very much, but it doesn't quite succeed. Have you thought of writing a novel? I thought if one more person writes me that and says, have you thought of writing a novel, I'm going to sit down and write a novel. And that's what happened, and it was accepted. But it wasn't as much of a transition from short story to novel as you might think, because many of the characters that I had been writing about in my stories turned out to serve very usefully as characters in the first novel I wrote.
So what kind of short stories came before Fire in the Morning?
Oh, small town stories. There was one I remember I liked a lot, but I've lost it now, called The Drifter. About a man who, very attractive guy who drifted into town and got involved with various of the women in town, and turned out that he wasn't much of a catch. He just was rather attractive and, you know, exciting. And time you immediately pick another target. Keep on down the list. It's harder to get stories now published now than it used to be, because so many magazines have cut back on the number they publish.
Yeah, short stories seem to not be as available as they were when I was even in high school.
Well, I think a lot of people are writing them, but the publication area that you can aim at is so much smaller. There are some good literary magazines that really get around. But there are a whole host of little magazines that will probably publish you, but on the other hand, they have such a small circulation, you know, you're not reaching many people, but still it's helpful. Somebody wrote a story called We All Start in a Little Magazine.
After Fire in the Morning came Voice at the Back Door.
No, there was another novel there called This Crooked Way that was about a man who came out of the hills and became a Delta planter. And that's out of print now. Voice at the Back Door has been in print for, 43 years.
Yeah, 1956.
Yeah, it went on and on and on. It's been translated into about, I guess, 10 different languages. And it keeps up this appeal because I didn't realize it when I was writing it, I think it's the last time you could have treated a black-white situation on a local, fairly local basis. After that period, many things opened up that led everything immediately to resonate on a national or at least a statewide basis. And that was a story that was contained within the time where it happened. And so that made the novel easier to cohere and bring together. And for the rest of its appeal, I don't know. People seem to like the characters and the writing.
I've read that of the voice at the back door that you said that when you were writing that you were questioning your own feelings, your own attitudes.
Oh, I was. I grew up in my racial attitudes while I was writing that book, because being a diagonal Southern and from all the people I respected and loved, having heard the same message of how one's supposed to behave and think through the years, I still had a lot of the residue of that left. And as I wrote the book and began to see in print and description, that is, in manuscript and in description, just how and what people were saying and doing, I began to form my own opinions much better and to see where I stood much better. So it was a learning experience for me.
Is that the case in other things that you've written as well?
I think it's the case for every writer. I read a good deal on that just recently, that people in writing are discovering. A writer that's got everything mapped out in advance and knows everything that's going to happen might as well just not write, seems to me. But the discovery process that's going on during, you know, you have your idea, you have pretty much the idea of where you want to have your characters, but just how it will develop and how it will involve you and the reader too, perhaps, is yet to be known, and you're venturing into the unknown when you write something. At least not 100% known.
Yeah. How have characters surprised you over time, then?
Oh, let me see. I can't remember exactly. My last novel was The Night Travelers. I don't know if you've read it. It's about a couple that were pretty much driven into Canada. I lived in Canada for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew people like this. The man had come up there because he was a war objector to the Vietnam War. And his wife, who's the main character in the book, was there because she followed him. But one of the controlling things in her life was her mother, who was always abrasive and domineering with her. And gradually, I began to see, because this woman is pretty prominent in the book, that she was really schizophrenic. And I didn't realize at first when I was writing about her. It's just some of the things that she did was so extraordinary that I began to wonder, you know, I believe I'm writing accurately about this woman, but what's the matter with her? And suddenly, toward the end of the book, I realized she had been schizophrenic all along.
Hmm. In a short story or in a novel, are there times when you find yourself wondering, what are these people doing? Why are they behaving the way they?
Yes, and then I realize I may have lost control. That's one thing. And the second thing,
that's not a good thing.
Maybe just going to pot, and I need to put it in the bottom drawer and forget it for a while.
Yeah.
The third thing is I need to set it aside, but in a different way of thinking. Well, I won't trifle with this so much now. I'll write something else. But if I've let it sit a while, and there was still something. My friend Mavis Scallon often says this, if I look at it again and something is vital, is stirring there, and I try to see what that vital point is, and you may have to throw out some of it and start from a different place in it, let it develop again. So it's a question of what goes dead on you completely and what retains a spark of vitality and truth and all the rest of it.
The vitality in fiction, does it come from character or plot? Is it possible to say one or the other?
Oh, I don't know. I imagine it comes from the writer. No, what primarily interests you in some stories is, of course, plot. I think that's true. But on the whole, I think my major interest in anything is character, because Henry James said character is action. So then you've eradicated the question, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
Because plot is action, too, and different turns and twists of action. But if you say character is action, then you've got it.
Hmm.
because nothing that the character can do. The only thing is accident. I've often written stories that had something to do with accident, because accident is unpredictable and may change lives in various ways. The story I wrote called The Lady in the Piazza,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've read that, it's about a girl that accidentally got kicked on the head with a Shetland pony when she was a child, and it damaged her mentality.
Right.
And so this accident, unpredictable by any act of character that anybody had in mind or could have perpetrated, nobody had it against her, nobody had it in for, just created in a way the whole story. So there is that element that can come in. So I don't think you can say character is action in that sense, but almost all senses you can.
Mm. In a short story in the collection Jack of Diamonds,
mm-hmm.
which is a collection from 1988, I don't know when the individual pieces were written, but the first story in that collection, Jean-Pierre,
yes.
Yes. He's a French-Canadian, and this is a love story.
Yes.
A French-Canadian and an English-Canadian, Callie.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a kind of a collision of people and politics there, I think.
Yes. That story, if you look at it carefully, was written, not written in a time when we were first there, but set during the 60s when we were first living in Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
And the conflicts that sharpened and rose up out of the two races there, two nationalities there, got sharper and more defined later, but in the 60s, it was pretty dormant, and it was just simply a fact that people who lived on the east side of Montreal were generally French-Canadian. The others in the west were English. The English looked down on the French. We experienced that then, not as a real conflict, but as a state of being,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I was getting at in the story. Callie and her lover and future husband, Jean-Pierre, upset that dormant sense when they got together, and I thought it was a rather touching story.
I like it very much.
I was just real fond of that story, because to me, a lot of people who read it thought of it in terms of, I don't know when it was, the 80s when I finally had published it, was published in the New York. But if you look at it, it clearly dates itself in the 60s and moves forward on that basis. And, you know, everything refers to those dormant facts that were there in social life and business life and everything else. So it works on that premise. Jean-Pierre, he disappeared in the middle of the story.
Right. That's the action, I suppose.
Yeah, but it's motivated, too, I think, by... It's all the way through it, but I never said why, or he never said why. I think he felt supervised and judged by the English community that he had to do business with.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he felt he had to leave for a while because of his, his business position. And perhaps I should have explained it more. But she was the main character, and the whole subject of the story was the effect it had on her. So I didn't go farther into it than that, only he did come back.
You know, knowing now what we know about the situation in Canada with, you know, the troubles.
Yeah, the troubles.
The troubles in Canada. You know, here we have this couple. There is this tremendous hunger for one another. They marry within a month's time, and then he leaves. He says he has to leave. And Callie is there coping, and, you know, she is saying he's not really gone, that even in absence, someone is still there.
Yeah, I know. They had a very passionate relationship.
Yeah.
I think that's what she felt.
And, you know, if one can look at this story and sort of also feel this political tug, this cultural tug that is going on in Canada.
Mm-hmm. It really is prophetic of that, I guess you'd say.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, it's an enormous, Quebec's an enormous country. They've thought of separating because they look at themselves geographically. The number of square miles is staggering. I don't know if it's bigger than Texas or not, but the fact is so little is habitable in a temperate zone way. But you have a lot of wild places. Did you ever read that book, Kamaraska? It was made into a movie some years ago.
Mm-mm.
It's about a man who was the sort of lord of the manor, a signory, as they call him. He'd inherited property he charges into town like a wild man and wants a wife, and this very gently brought up girl is his choice. And because he has prestige and land and money, people who raised her let her go to him, but it's a ghastly, hair-raising experience she had. And it's a wonderfully interesting story. It's based on a real case, because she comes back ill, and the doctor attending her, she and the doctor fall in love, and then the man's going to come back and get her, and Tasso is his name, and they go up there and kill him. And so it's resolves itself into a murder case, and as well as a love story. So this is a rather primitive environment in a lot of those reaches of Quebec. And French Canadians you meet, even though they've been in city life for many years, still have that aspect of vein in them of the frontier and the wildness and the bush. They are quite interesting people, I think, very intelligent.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite novel, a favorite short story of your own?
I don't know. I generally think my last novel I wrote is my favorite, my last story I wrote is my favorite. So many people have liked a story called The Cousins in Jack of Diamonds that I begin to think, well, maybe they're right. Maybe that was a very successful story. And then I always remember, too, the circumstances under which a story was written. For instance, The Cousins, I was at the Villa Cervellone in Bellagio in Italy on Lago di Como. It's a Rockefeller Foundation villa where you can get a fellowship for an appointment to go and work for 5 weeks, I think it was. And I was there thinking, in this beautiful garden and lovely studio, I had a good deal of manuscript with me, but I was thinking what to write that would bring together the South and Italy, the two places that had meant the most to me. And I just suddenly thought of these cousins going abroad for a summer and having all the camaraderie of the past and then entering new experience abroad, especially in Italy. So that was what made my story. I had no idea where it was going. I just started writing one day. And then it's almost a novel. It's a bit 40 pages long, I think.
Mm.
It's a novella almost.
Mm-hmm.
But I did tend to like that. I liked the business venture. I think it was successful.
That's also in Jack of Diamonds.
And you know, Wealthy, I know like Jack of Diamonds better than any. And I don't know, that whole book to me is composed of probably some of my best writing and that I had a good time doing. I love that form. A long short story can bring in many things that a novel can also deal with, but the length is somehow sweeter.
Well, I really enjoyed Landscapes of the Heart and Fire in the Morning and the pieces from Jack and Jack of Diamonds that I have read, and I look forward to reading more of your work.
Well, thank you. A lot of it's in print. Some of it goes in and out of print. Some of my stories, a book of them, out of print, though many of them are contained in a collection called The Light in the Piazza and Other Italian Stories. There are a number of those, and The Cousins is in that. And then there's a collection called On the Gulf that is filled. These are all reprints, you understand, mm-hmm. of stories that have to do with settings on the Gulf of Mexico and the Gulf states, you know, Mississippi, Alabama.
Which is a place you love.
What?
Which is a place you love.
Oh, yeah, I did.
Before Camille?
That gambling down there, it sort of disillusioned me. And then there was the hurricane, you know, that just about wiped it out. But I did adore it back in the olden days, and probably still would. I just haven't lived down there in one time.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, I was happy to. All your callers are taking a nap, I think.
I think you are. Could be right. Either they, I think they were just, you know, enjoyed listening to you talk.
Well, thank you. Very tactful. Your name is Celeste, but what is your last name?
Quinn.
Quinn. Well, Celeste Quinn, I enjoyed it a lot.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Elizabeth Spencer has been our guest. Look for her memoir, Landscapes of the Heart. It's published by Random House.